We wrap up the program with an interview of a local activist, Sami of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, discussing some of the harassment Arab and Palestinian activists face in their fight against political repression.
If you can just tell us a little bit about AROC and how long you've been on the collective.
Yeah, I mean, so let's see. Well, I got started in the organization in 2005. I think the organization, I'm not sure how far back it goes. And then in around 2007 or 2008, we changed our name to AROC, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. And it's had, you know, been engaged in different forms of advocacy and organizing. And right now, you know, when we became AROC, our focus really was on organizing, meaning political education, leadership development, running campaigns within the Arab community, and tying that organizing within the Arab community to broader struggles for justice and working with you know, other immigrant rights organizations, other social justice organizations, economic justice organizations, and of course, people of color and national liberation organizations.
So I guess the next question is that a lot of people believe Rasmiya's case is a byproduct of the anti-war 23. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could give a little background on that and then as well AROC's role in the Committee to Stop FBI Repression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting that you phrase it as believe that it's connected. I mean, it was never... I mean, those of us who've been involved... I mean, it was never any question, or we never thought it was anything that sort of needed explanation. But I guess, you know, when you listen to, when you go back and recount the timeline of events, it becomes pretty obvious. And I think that, you know, we became involved and were aware of it as soon as the raids and subpoenas happened in the fall and winter of 2010. That it wasn't just AROC, but a lot of organizations locally were really appalled at what happened and concerned about, you know, what was going on. Why were these anti-war international solidarity activists, why were their homes being raided, their property being taken? They were giving subpoenas to be called in front of a grand jury for what? And you know, what we suspected and what we still believe is true, that it was for their First Amendment their First Amendment activities. It was for being critical of foreign policy. It was for, you know, talking about social justice and social change. And a lot of people were, I mean, it was just really in shock. And so there were a number of organizations that came together, formed a committee. It wasn't a formal coalition, but it was really a defense committee. I don't think anybody really knew how long it was going to go on. And it was people from labor unions. It was other anti-war activists. It was people of color organizations from the Black Liberation Movement, from the Philippines Liberation Movement, and of course the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And AROC was one of the members. And we felt very close to this work because you know, we see the Arab American Action Network as, you know, very closely tied to us. I mean, not only because people have personal relationships to them, but because they're doing the sort of work that's very similar to what we hope to be doing, to be working in the Arab community, to be empowering people and developing their leadership, and exactly the sort of stuff that Rasmiya was doing. I mean, that's exactly what we want to do, and we've often learned from them, collaborated with them. We, you know, people from AROC went out to the first USPCN and the second USPCN conferences in Chicago. And, you know, then we got to learn a lot. And, you know, the people who were on the collective learned a lot from what they were doing. Yeah. And so it was you know, more than just politically important for us to be involved, but it was also personally important for a lot of people. And so then, you know, the story after that is a story of, you know, a political defense committee. And, you know, we had demonstrations and we talked at first about, you know, what it meant to defend them. What do they need? We were on national conference calls talking about, you know, different ways of trying to figure out what was going on, why people were being attacked, how it happened, and then how it can be stopped. And, you know, there were different lines of working for it. And, you know, part of it was a legal defense, and part of it was a political defense, and that took the form of people, you know, getting letters from organizations, letters from congresspeople, you know, sort of asking that the grand jury be ended, that people's properties be returned, and concern about what was going on. And we had demonstrations at San Francisco Federal Building, at the Oakland Federal Building, and you know, worked to raise awareness with the legislators that, you know, as part of the legislative strategy. And then, you know, as the case drew on, we had more and more time to really talk about and digest what was going on. And, you know, I think a lot of us were, I don't know, somewhat aware of the history of political repression in the U.S., but it gave us time to really talk about it and analyze it. And, you know, we realized that that this is, I mean, I think naively a lot of people and myself at times have thought that we were past the age of McCarthyism, that we were past the age of COINTELPRO, when we know that that's not true. And I think that, you know, I started first to learn this when there was the case of the San Francisco 8, which was very, you know, close to home here. And then I, you know, started to realize, you know, firsthand how it was going on. And then with this, it was really firsthand. And when you go back and look, there's actually, it's just a consistent history of the government using tactics like this to repress social justice movements. And it's really shocking when you go into the history. And then you start making, like, tying, seeing the thread of this political repression that goes back to, you know, Red Scare and all these laws against communism. And you can see how the case of the Los Angeles 8 fits into this, how, you know, they use these laws to attack and re-attack people for their First Amendment activities. And you see the connections to the liberation, the Black liberation movements and the Indian movements in the 60s and 70s and the 70s and the 80s. And you just... And it just all starts to come together. And then that led to a conversation of, you know, well, we also need to be prepared to defend ourselves. And really, I mean, if we need to learn from this, and we need to use this moment to bring our movements closer together and figure out how can we stop political repression. And part of that stopping political repression is really, you know, drawing a line with this case. So anyway, so there was the defense, and the defense then, you know, grew into, you know, other conversations. And then when they raided Carlos Montes' home, and I guess that was 2011, and at that time the case was also further unfolding and people were learning more, that brought new people into the movement, into the, you know, the defense work. We, at that point, then were able to bring Carlos Montes here into the Bay Area a couple times and draw people from, really, like, people came from Fresno and from Santa Cruz and Watsonville, and they came just to see Carlos because, you know, of his connection to the Chicano movement, and people were really concerned, and he came and talked about his case, and that brought some more people into the organizing. And, you know, thankfully his case was a victory for us. I mean, they brought some completely fake charges, which was unsurprising because that's the tactic. There's the tactic of the grand juries and the false charges. And so, you know, the movement was strong then, but there was always this, you know, and the case then got dragged on and on. We had the victory with Carlos. The case dragged on and on. There was Hatem's bank accounts that got frozen, and then people's property was returned, but not Hatem's. And you know, for us, we kept our organizing going, and we kept our conversations going.
And Hatem is the director of the
one of the directors of the AAAN, yeah. And so, you know, so the question was always like, well, what are they doing? And then when they, you know, charged Tres Mía, that's why it wasn't a surprise to us. I mean, this was just the next development of the case. And it fit so neatly in with the pattern of what they've done in the past. And it's what they do to Carlos Montes, and it's what they do with grand juries. They want to squash First Amendment activities. They want to squash, you know, people just from speaking out. And so they do it any way they can. And grand juries are one way of doing that. Grand juries are one way of, you know, catching people in traps and, you know, finding small inconsistencies and then charging them with, with perjury and so the fact that they, the charges, the fake charges against Carlos Montes were sort of, you know, a precursor to them having fake charges brought against Tres Mía. And so it's all like, when they charged Tres Mía, it was a surprise because, I mean, I didn't know, you know, in my realm of defense work, Tres Mía wasn't on my radar. I was sort of concerned with the people who had actually been subpoenaed, but it was not a surprise. It's in the end, you know, what I think this is they were looking to attack and silence people. First, the anti-war groups who they initially infiltrated. I mean, and we should go back to that, the infiltrator that they put in the anti-war groups, and then the international solidarity movement people who were subpoenaed, and finally, the attacks on leaders, and Carlos Montes was one, and now Tres Mía is another. Who are leaders of important movements that are organizing people, empowering people. That's not what people in power want. So it wasn't a surprise to us that they made up some false charges it seems to me like it's an act of desperation. They want to attack in any way they can, and that was one thing that they're like, well, maybe we can do this, and that's what they did.
Okay, thank you. One other question. So, is AROC still continuing with, or what form of resistance or organizing is AROC involved in now to keep up with the developments of the case?
Yeah. What we're doing now is we still have a loose network of people who are committed to taking action. And I think right now we're, what we've been doing is keeping involved with the people, keeping in touch with the people in Chicago and trying to find ways that we can support as needed. I think that because Tres Mía's case is a little bit different than the sort of demonstrations that we were used to having at the federal building, at federal buildings that are don't, you know, always seem as effective. And we've been trying to take the lead from, you know, what they feel they need. And we've had a number of fundraisers, and we've had a number of awareness events, events specifically about Tres Mía. And now what we are constantly doing is Tres Mía is an integral part of our work. Talking about the case and talking about Tres Mía's situation is an integral part of our work, that whenever we're, you know, going to talk, for example, at May Day, the issue of what's going on with Tres Mía is at the forefront. So, you know, as much as, you know, that there's the activities that her defense committee calls for, we, you know, are ready to support them.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sammy.